Welcome to We Are the Rock, the official podcast for Rivers of Hope Counseling. Now, let's join our hosts and guest therapist as they discuss this month's topic.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back at We Are the Rock. I'm Claudia Morcello.
Adela Jaquette.
Devin Drake.
Alyssa Maxey.
Yes, and we have the pleasure today of interviewing Alyssa Maxey. She's the licensed resident in counseling, and today we'll be talking about autism, and we have plenty of questions for you, so are you prepared?
Sure, yes.
So let's start with defining the term. What is autism?
So autism, just kind of a, I guess, SparkNote version or a condensed version from the DSM would be anyone that is dealing with maybe emotional or social deficits. So that's kind of a condensed version, but we can see autism in many different forms. So it can be not picking up like on social cues. It can have a sensory component to it, maybe hyper or hyposensitive to sensory outputs. So touch, different sounds. A lot of times we see people that are dealing with autism, socialization and communication skills are really difficult for them. And then they can also maybe sometimes have a diagnosis of like an intellectual disability, but that doesn't have to always be present of what we see. So I like to say that individuals on the spectrum are all individually unique. You're never going to see one autistic kid that is the same. So they all have kind of different qualities from what I've seen and the kids that I've worked with.
Teens. Okay. And then I saw that you mentioned the spectrum. Can you like define the spectrum for me so that we have like a good aspect of how we look at the spectrum? I know there's three different levels of the spectrum.
Yeah. So there is three different levels of the spectrum. And I want to start kind of by defining that word spectrum. So when we're looking at spectrum, we're looking at kind of like a wide range, like a wide, just like I had said before, social component, sensory component there. And there are different levels. So when we're looking at the different levels, it's really the kind of sense of impairment that's there, what they can do if they need assistance, if they're able to do things like on their own. And then we look in, we get into like verbal and nonverbal. So we might see kids or teens that are on the spectrum that are, you know, both verbal and nonverbal. Those that are nonverbal maybe have more difficulties with communication and socialization. And then we have, you know, the verbal, which would be considered maybe some higher functioning. And they also used to use the term Asperger's for high functioning, but they actually took that out as a diagnosis from the DSM. So I know people still use that word, you know, higher functioning. So there are definitely different levels of autism on the spectrum.
So when you're saying that there's different levels of the spectrum, are there points where this where someone would test on the different spectrums at the same time?
Sure. And with testing, I would like to say with testing, there's no single like blood test or you know, test that they can go under, you know, to actually diagnose. But we do have like assessments to assess for autism. So it's really just finding out from the parents and, you know, the symptoms and things like that. So there's actually not, you know, an actual like blood test or anything like that to actually diagnose autism. But if we are seeing some of those signs and symptoms in children, or, you know, we catch it early on, then there's different like instruments that they use to assess. And they can also use that to assess the different levels, maybe in the different areas that the child's struggling in.
Okay. And you talk about symptoms and signs. Can you tell us about those warning signs of autism?
Sure.
You know, and I always think about new parents, you know,
yeah.
Everything is new for new parents. And yeah. How do you pick up those Sure. Red flags.
Yeah, sure. So a lot of what I have seen, but what I've also researched and read is when we're looking at kids, a lot of parents notice when they're getting to like maybe that school age, right? They'll see maybe some behavioral things going on in school. So we see maybe some acting out in class, or maybe they're not socializing like with peers, like they're off to themselves, or they're not wanting to interact with peers. So some parents may not see it until school age, preschool, kindergarten. Others may notice that their child has like developmental delays. So that would be in like speech, walking, talking, things like that. So those are some of the warning signs that a lot of what I've seen that parents have, they may think like something's up, wait, what's, they're not meeting these developmental milestones. And then others, unfortunately, you know, well, I won't say unfortunately, but they catch it later. They don't see that until, you know, school age, some of these behaviors. And then they're wondering, could this be, could they be on the spectrum? So the social aspect of it.
You mentioned that, like, they could be like acting out in class. Could that be like conceived as something different from just like autism? Could it just be like they're just being a kid acting out?
Yeah, so that is something important to look at too, because we see different, you know, parents that may see behavioral issues or things like that. It could be ADHD, you know, it could be oppositional defiant, or it could just be normal children just kind of acting out. So I think a lot of it is the degree of what it, the frequency, you know, the degree of how intense it is in the classroom, and if it is affecting them in the classroom, like if they're getting sent home from school, or if the teacher can't maybe handle the student and needs the parents, you know, assistance. So I also think it has to do with the severity of maybe some of the behaviors in the classroom too. Maybe they're acting out. So then we might want to look at like, is this autism, or is this attention-seeking behavior? Like, what is that? And I think that the testing, too, helps with that. But as far as the other component, too, we want to be looking at, is there any developmental delays as well that we're seeing, like in speech and things like that?
Okay. Are there times when autism goes undiagnosed because it was diagnosed with something else, or...
Sure. Yeah. So I have seen a lot of different cases where it may have either been misdiagnosed or it hasn't been diagnosed. So we may see, like I said, again, like children that may have, because there may even be children that have sensory issues, but they're not, they don't have autism, or they're not on the spectrum. So they may, there's other kids that I've seen that may have those sensory issues, but they're not necessarily, you know, on the spectrum. Or, you know, like I said, with the behavioral component, there may be some kids on the spectrum that have, you know, the behavioral side or acting out. But then that could be, you know, ADHD or ODD when we're being defiant as well. So it's really important to look at everything too, not just one component of it, because we see a lot of different things in autism with kids.
What is ODD?
So ODD is oppositional defiant disorder. And a lot of, from what I have seen too, a lot of times doctors, or, you know, they will kind of join that together, the ODD, like they have oppositional defiant as well as they're on the spectrum too, because some of the symptoms kind of overlap a little bit, as well as acting out and things like that. So a lot of times I've seen that doctors may either misdiagnose, right? They may say, well, this kid is showing signs maybe of autism, but it's oppositional defiant, which when we're looking at oppositional defiant, we are looking at some of those overlapping, as well as with, as far as behavioral, being defiant, not following rules, having trouble following, listening to directives, following rules from those in authority, getting in trouble, you know, at school and things like that. Yeah.
So just taking a step back, you mentioned the symptoms and alerts for parents. What if my child has, for people that are listening right now to the podcast and just listening to the different symptoms, what if my child has all those symptoms? What are the steps to take?
Sure. So first, if you feel like your child is experiencing some of these symptoms, and you're, as you know, as a parent, you're wondering, right? Like, my child may be experiencing some symptoms, but I don't know what's going on, then we definitely want to have them tested, right? Have an assessment to see if they meet all the criteria for that. And normally that's, you know, giving them resources, whether it's from counselor or, you know, they may ask us for resources, or they may go to a provider, you know, a behavioral doctor or something like, you know, that can test for that. So they then from that point, it may be either ruled out and then they know what action to take further, or they are able to determine, yes, your child is on the spectrum. And so then they're able to kind of move forward once they have that diagnosis and knowing what's going on with the child. So I think a lot of times parents don't know. They might have a good idea because they're seeing some of the signs and symptoms, but they do want to almost every time go to doctor just to get that diagnosis rather than making it for themselves beforehand.
And this may be something very new for a lot of people that have never even attempted to call a therapist for assistance. So do you think it's important to also perhaps have a conversation with a pediatrician, their pediatrician, so maybe he or she can like help them navigate that? Because I can see how for some people may be a little bit difficult.
Yeah, I definitely think that that's probably the best place to start, starting out with the pediatrician, because then they can refer them, you know, out maybe somewhere that specializes in behavioral, you know, medicine or specializes in autism. So I do think that speaking with the pediatrician would be a good place to start. Yeah, definitely.
Okay. And speaking of pediatricians, like how important is it to like catch on to all these symptoms early in their childhood?
Yeah. I think that is really important because then we can put the parent, you know, we can put an action plan in place to kind of help. And sometimes that's like multifaceted. So, you know, they may have possibly like a behavior plan in school or like an IEP to help them in the school setting. But they may also have, as they get older, parents may want them feel like that they may benefit from like ABA services, which is applied behavioral analysis. So that's where someone kind of comes in the home and works with them on social skills and different things like that. So I do think it is important to catch it early on too, because then you can figure out what services is best for your child and help them, you know, in the different areas. Maybe it's social or maybe it's sensory or behavioral. So it's really just multi, you know, fast. It's many different areas. And as I said before, no one child is alike when it comes to being on the spectrum. They all have maybe different needs, you know. So.
Okay. And then with that being said, for like catching it early, what if you did catch it late? How difficult would it be to really like,
yeah,
kind of backtrack and then get them the treatment that they need?
Sure. So I think a lot of times if it is caught late, then maybe it wasn't a significant maybe behavior issue there, or maybe the parents didn't catch it because it wasn't, they weren't seeing what was going on. So maybe it wasn't interfering, right, in their day-to-day or like with school and different things like that. So maybe someone when they get older, you know, like in their late teens or early 20s, think that they might be on the spectrum, right? And then they want to get help for themselves. So I think, and what I've seen in a lot of cases is parents tend to notice either when they are not reaching those developmental milestones, and it normally does alert the parents, but it may be a case where mom and dad aren't present, right? Or caregivers aren't there as involved. And then the child is kind of the one, once they get older, okay, I know something is going on and I want to get help like for myself. So I do definitely think there's cases where parents may not be as involved and it is caught later in life. A lot of the cases I have seen, parents are very proactive as far as they know something's, you know, going on, whether it be early as a toddler or when they start getting in that school age, like preschool, kindergarten, things like that. So.
Okay. So I guess to kind of switch gears a little bit. So I've seen a lot where there's children or people on the spectrum where they're like really, really good at something. Where does that come from? Is it like where it's because they're not good here?
Yeah.
They there's a focus somewhere else and it's like obsessing over, or how does it happen to where they're like savant in certain things?
Yeah. So what I've seen is a lot of children on the spectrum are actually very intelligent and very smart. Some of them, we see patterns of being very particular, like liking routine, having repetition of certain things, being able to like make things, or in the arts, being very artistic and things like that. So we do see that a lot. And that could be, you know, just from being detailed oriented with needing that routine. We know that a lot of what I've seen is they will be very distressed or triggered if their routine changes. So, but also a lot of children I've met on the spectrum too, they can make things. They're very, very bright in certain areas too. So they, you know, like it, that would be a case by case basis as well. Each of them I've ever came into contact or interacted with have their own individual like talents, things that they're really good at. So.
Okay. Yeah, to piggyback off of that, like I've worked with quite a few people that had autism. One girl in particular, she had Asperger's, and she was always into a routine. And then, you know, I work at Tropical Smoothies, so sometimes it's a little more fast-paced than normal. So her normally being in a slower routine, and then all of a sudden it picks up, it's like she can't take it all. I mean, at one point, yeah, I was like, oh, hey, like, are you sure this is for you in this fast-paced environment? But she ended up leaving, working like a slower job that kind of fits her routine a little bit better. And then I've also worked with another gentleman where he had to get in the routine in order to get it down, but it took a while to actually, like, develop that routine first.
Yeah.
And to actually, like, learn it. And then I know that, like, listening to some people, I believe Elon Musk also, he said that he had Asperger's, so he's a very intelligent person. So I do know a lot of people stick to their routine as they go through their daily life, and to switch them off of that, sometimes it might throw them a little out of whack.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that is maybe something that they navigate through as well as they get older, you know, working with a lot of like children and teens, of course, that's like to them, it's very stressful, and it's sometimes they may escalate in their behaviors, right? If their routine is thrown off, even a simple, like, you know, disruption in their day-to-day routine. We see that like in younger kids and even teenagers. But I definitely think it's something as they get older, they can be able to do things like everyone else, you know, hold jobs and things like that, that have routine. It may be a struggle at first, but that is also a case by case basis on what works, you know, if that's something that they can be able to navigate through and handle as well. But I do think it may get easier as they get older as well, you know?
So what jobs would you say are the ideal jobs for someone on the spectrum to have who like the same pace,
yeah,
the same daily routine?
So this may be like an office job, something maybe that's not as fast paced, maybe something sitting down, or maybe something like even like working from home, because we know too that a lot of people, they on the spectrum, some do not like to socialize with others. They are fine with being, you know, by themselves or alone. You know, they enjoy their own company too, so they may do better, you know, with a job where they're, you know, in solitude or kind of, you know, to themselves and are able to work and things like that, rather than a job maybe at like fast food or somewhere where they're around like a whole bunch of people. But I don't think that it's that they couldn't do that. I've seen, and you know, I've seen stories and watched different like YouTube videos and things like that of different people that have been on the spectrum that have gotten jobs and you know, worked with their family, owned their family business, you know, helped grow with their family and their family business, and they were part, and they loved it, like selling ice cream or coming up with their own business. I think that there was something in the news about this young man that had autism, and he had came up with his own business. So mm-hmm. It's really cool, like food business, which is really awesome. So
we talked a little bit about routines and jobs. Can you tell us, what does autism look like in general, living with autism? What does that look like?
Sure. So there again, it is multifaceted, right? It's this, when we look at the spectrum, it is sometimes difficult because not every one person is going to have the same symptoms and things like that. But we want to maybe look for, a lot of people on the spectrum maybe struggle with making eye contact. They struggle in social situations, just picking up on social cues. So maybe saying like, you know, where we normally someone does something nice for us and we say, thank you, right? Or you're welcome. They may not understand that. They may not understand certain emotions either. So like if someone's sad or someone's angry, they may not understand, you know. Most of us, you know, if someone, we see someone upset or crying or sad, we might ask what's wrong. They don't normally pick up on those social cues as far as things going on. So I think a lot of it is social in social areas and communication and things like that. With the sensory and, you know, then behavioral, that I feel like is more of a case by case basis. It's not all going to be all for everyone. But a lot of what we are seeing with a lot of people on or individuals on the spectrum is that social component there, that they're lacking those social cues, emotional and social cues in their communication and how they interact with others.
Okay. And then, like, in your opinion, what would be like a cause for autism?
Sure. So a lot of research has actually been done that it's a genetic component. So, you know, if you had a mother or father or great-grandma or grandmother, you know, you're more likely to. There's also different like genetic mutations that they've said that could cause autism, chromosomes and things like that, like Fragile X syndrome, just different types of genetic things going on. Now, there have also been research that in the past that's been done on like vaccines, like do vaccines cause autism? There has been no research to show that that's actually true, that's been able to prove that, but that has been something that people have thought to cause autism. So a lot of it, I think it could be genetic. Another thing that they say puts people more at risk for developing autism is when the mother is older. So like we're looking at like she's having a child when she's older, maybe I would say 40s, you know, upper 40s, you know, later in life, the child can be more predisposed to developing autism. Another thing is if the mother has any type of infection, you know, while she's you know, that could be a risk factor too for a child developing autism if the mom is not healthy, you know, as well. So that's another thing that we see too. But I think a lot of it is genetic, that a lot of the research that I've done and I've heard has been backed by like, it's genetic, a genetic thing. Biology. Yeah.
I kind of want to backtrack. So when you were talking about living with autism, it kind of reminded me of a show that I was watching. I don't know if you've ever seen The Big Bang Theory.
Yes.
So Sheldon Cooper, would you say that he shows a lot of spectrum signs with, you know, between his roommate agreements and having to have the same daily schedule, like a bathroom schedule and all that stuff? Would you say that that's like?
Sure. So I think that definitely there's some components there. Definitely like with the sameness and having routine as well. But we can also see that like repetitive behaviors and things like that in OCD. So we want to make sure that, you know, and some individuals on the spectrum also have some OCD like tendencies as well. But I think really we want to also look at like really what's important is picking up on those social cues. You know, that would be, I think that is a hallmark in most individuals that, we're seeing with on the spectrum is just picking up on those social cues. So, you know, repetitive behaviors, sameness, things like that, that could definitely be something to look into when it comes to that too. Yeah.
Because in a couple episodes, you know, it's they've had to tell him multiple times, like, you're not picking up on the social cues. And he's like, I can't. That's not what I do.
Right. I can't. Yeah. I think another thing too is them like not being able to, you know, not understanding the social cues, you know, too. Sometimes people may not want to, you know, or we might see certain personality traits, different personality traits, you know, more, we see people that are more like empath and empathetic too. So if we can kind of see that they just really do not understand or not picking up on emotional or, you know, social interactions. So that's something to kind of distinguish as well between that and maybe a personality disorder like narcissism.
So is there a cure for autism?
So there's no cure for autism. Autism is something that is lifelong. So it's something that, you know, an individual would have to manage. There's no cure for it. but there are things that can be done to help manage it. You know, there's individuals that are on the spectrum can go to live, you know, full adult lives and not need assistance. You know, I think it depends on, that's when we're looking like more into the higher functioning. They may need some assistance in their younger years, and they may need assistance throughout life as well. But I definitely think that that's when we look into like verbal and nonverbal as well. Like the one, you know, individuals that are on the spectrum that are more nonverbal may need more, you know, assistance as well, because with that communication barrier there.
When you say assistance, are you referring to medical, therapy, a combination?
Sure. Yeah, combination. Okay. Medical, and then working with the doctor, and then maybe therapy as well. And some individuals may need that lifelong, whereas others, they may, you know, have ABA therapy or counseling, you know, mental health skill building, you know, working on skills, you know, hygiene, whether it be paying bills, you know, different things like that. But they may not need that forever.
So you were saying AVA or ABA?
ABA.
ABA, what is that?
So ABA is Applied Behavior Analysis. What that is that is a specific service for individuals on the spectrum. And what that does is that uses like behavior modification techniques. So it's just teaching them different things, whether it could be simple things like shapes, the different seasons, different holidays, different like animals, reptiles, you know, amphibian, different things like that. And so what you do, it's more fast paced, and you're kind of using behavior modification techniques. So you're doing a technique with them in the home environment. And then you're giving them maybe like a 5 to 10 minute break. So it's working on behaviors, and it's also helping the parents kind of navigate in that home environment, how to handle some of the behaviors and things like that. So ABA is specifically designed for individuals on the spectrum, and it can be for both verbal or nonverbal individuals. So it's a way to think of it as like with an intensive in home, that's more like mental health, right? Which autism is mental health disorder, but we're looking at more, it's two different specific services. So I've seen individuals on the spectrum that have had intensive in-home services, but we typically recommend if that's really the main thing that's going on is they're on the spectrum, then ABA definitely is something to look at doing for them. So it's just a difference in like techniques used. Those techniques are behavior modification techniques are geared more towards individuals on the spectrum, but both services are done in the home. So
with all these, I guess with all the services and help, it sounds like it can get quite expensive. Is there help for people who can't necessarily afford all the help to help their children?
Yeah, so definitely, you know, individuals are on, like if they have Medicaid or, you know, then they may get services, you know, if they don't have a specific insurance carrier, things like that. Or if it, you know, I know with ABA services, a lot of like insurance carriers, or depending on if they don't have insurance, they will accept them too. But there's also programs, if there's like a community service board in their area or a program, then they may offer different types of things for those kids too, at a, you know, budget friendly, you know, for the family and things like that. That's just maybe different. I've came across different like summer programs and things like that. We've also seen individuals on the spectrum receive like therapeutic day treatment in the schools too. So that's like having a counselor in the school during the school day. So that's not uncommon to see that as well. And they're actually kind of doing away with the therapeutic day treatment and replacing that with outpatient counseling in the school. I know in Southern Virginia. So yeah.
Okay. So in terms of resources, now that we are, COVID is kind of winding down, there's a high demand for mental health resources in general. And a friend of mine tried to contact a therapist for her daughter, and her daughter is on the wait list. She's number 16, and it's been 2 months. So I'm wondering, with autism, is there any special considerations when you call a specialist or try to get an appointment? Does your placing like it's expedited, because we talk about early detection and how important that is? So
Right. Do
you have anything to add to that? For parents, I'm just thinking, because of what we're experiencing right now in terms of seeking mental health assistance is just so challenging now.
Right, right. What I have seen in my experience is a lot of them will start off if they're on a waiting list, like to see a pediatrician or to see a behavioral, you know, doctor to be tested for autism or to receive services, or if they are on a wait list, they will begin by getting their child into like outpatient therapy or what's called play therapy. So that can be beneficial, like in an outpatient setting, doing play therapy with starting doing play therapy with a child that's on the spectrum too, while they're waiting, maybe to get in to see the doctor. So, and then we look at it as maybe a multidimensional approach where most of the time in the past, I've recommended if I'm doing outpatient with a child or play therapy with the child, I would recommend they would also benefit from ABA in the home, because a lot of what we see is the parents are having issues with the child at school, and in the home, or one or the other. So a lot of them we see kind of go with that lower level of care while they're waiting to be seen, you know, or even if they don't know that their child is, they have maybe a good idea that they are on the spectrum, they don't know, but maybe they're waiting for testing.
And I know you mentioned play therapy a couple of times. What is play therapy?
So play therapy can be used with children anywhere between, I would say, the ages of, we start as young as 3 years old to about 10 or 11. And what play therapy does, play therapy can be used, and it's in an outpatient setting. So we can use that with kids to help them kind of better express maybe some things that are going on in life, you know, because a lot of times kids might be scared to go to a counselor, or they might not, they may be afraid to open up. So we use play. Through play, we work on social skills, we work on opening up about emotions and feelings and being able to manage intense feelings and things like that. So I think play therapy is very beneficial for younger kids that, you know, have went through trauma or, past trauma.
And then what would you recommend for like a teenager, like treatment wise
on the spectrum?
Yeah
So for a teenager, I would say outpatient, because they're a little bit older, and we still do depending on, that's one thing we look at as well, where they're at developmentally, right? So if the teen is at the developmental age of like a 8 or 9 year old, then we may do more fun, you know, type things with them. You know, if that's something to look at too, going back to if they're also struggling with an intellectual disability as well. So I think that definitely outpatient and doing play therapy with them too, depending on where they are, you know, intellectually, as well as the ABA in the home, because we see with a lot of what we've seen with teens that are both verbal and nonverbal is there is some defiance there in the home, right? And there's maybe they're not listening, or maybe mom and dad get frustrated because they can't get them to do basic things like keep up with hygiene or things like that. And so then the parents may become frustrated because they don't understand why they can't maybe sometimes do some of this, you know, and sometimes the other parents we see, they do understand. So a lot of times that's when we look at like ABA therapy can help with those things as well as intensive in home. ABA therapy, I feel like, is more geared though towards if they're just dealing with like just on the spectrum.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And then to kind of go off of that just a little bit, kind of go right field real quick. Why doesn't ADHD end up on the spectrum?
Okay. So with ADHD, a lot of times too, we might see autism by itself, but we might see a child that has autism that also is having symptoms of ADHD too. I've seen that in the past as well. But for ADHD, a child can have ADHD and it not impact them like socially. So when we're looking at ADHD, that just might be like difficulty concentrating, having trouble staying in their seat, maybe getting up a lot in class. But we can also see behavioral issues come out with children that have ADHD. So just because a child might be diagnosed with ADD or ADHD doesn't necessarily mean that they can't pick up on social cues or emotional cues, or they have maybe a deficit in communication skills and socialization skills. So.
Okay, so that's what would defer them from being on the spectrum to compared to being on it.
Correct. And sometimes, you know, we may like we may have a child that is on the spectrum, but they may also struggle with symptoms of ADHD. So they may have both. They may have not picking up on social cues, you know, not being able to communicate, you know, effectively or pick up on emotions or interactions with others, but they may also struggle with focusing in school, concentrating and things like that. So I have seen cases where there are kids or teens on the spectrum that also have symptoms of ADHD or a diagnosis of ADHD.
Kind of a fun question with everything going on. So with, I guess I've seen a lot of new medicines come about, you know, like CBD, mm-hmm. cannabis. Do you think that that kind of medicine does help in autism and I guess with a lot of autism symptoms?
Sure. So I've watched a lot of like documentaries and done a lot of research. So it has been shown that CBD can be effective. You know, medical CBD can be effective for different symptoms in helping, not, you know, that, like we said before, that's something they're always going to struggle with. Like that autism is not going to go away, but it can help manage some of the symptoms, whether it be just how, you know, maybe if it's a sensory thing, if sensory overload, it can kind of calm them down. We know that it's been proven to help with like seizures, epilepsy, things like that. So definitely, I think it can help. I don't know about, I definitely think it's like a case by case basis, but I think it, you know, depending on the child and what their needs are, that it can have a positive effect on them.
So what would you say the prerequisites for using cannabis would be with someone on the spectrum?
Sure. So, and that's something, you know, now too, where, you know, we've got the different states that have legalized, you know, cannabis and things like that. I know it used to be, you know, where there was only like a couple of states that did, you know, that it was legal. And so we would see like, there were several documentaries I watched where parents would travel and take their kids across the U.S. to the West Coast, you know, the West Coast to find doctors that would treat their children medically, and they would be able to get like a medical cannabis. So that would be considered legal, but it would help with, like we said before, things like if the child was having seizures or if emotional overload, maybe they were acting out and maybe hitting their head against the wall or trying to hurt, it would really just calm down the brain and help them. So I definitely think like that would be a discussion for the parent and the doctor to have. And then the doctor to say, hey, yeah, I think that this may would benefit because what we know is past research has shown that this is helping with the specific thing going on with the child.
No, you said calm down the brain. So is there a lot of instances where people on the spectrum, their brain is working like double time?
Sure. It can be. I have seen it a lot in like, especially those that are nonverbal, because they can't, if you look at it the way, like they can't communicate and they might get frustrated because, especially when when they're younger, but when they're hitting those years of like puberty and, you know, both males and females, because they can't, you know, their body's going through changes and they can't, being nonverbal, they can't express, right? So we may see like hitting behavior or, you know, to try to communicate, hitting walls, you know, maybe leaving marks on themselves or other people, kind of destructive behaviors. And then they may go into like sensory overload because they can't express. So I've definitely seen that in that frustration and aggression in kids and teens on the spectrum that are nonverbal, but I've also seen it in verbal as well.
And just going back very quickly in terms of cannabis and medication and treatment, how about nutrition? Because I know, for example, with depression, therapists usually suggest a well-balanced diet to stay away from certain foods like fast food and sodas and things like that, because that triggers a lot of those symptoms with depression. Yeah. What about autism? Are there some certain foods they should stay away from?
So I don't know about, you know, I think that's just like a generalized, like everyone would benefit from eating healthy, right? Eating a nutrition and balanced diet. So when we look at nutrition can help with a lot of different things. whether we are looking at like a vitamin deficiency, right? Like we're looking at the medical side of it, and maybe our body needs more of a certain type of nutrition or a food or a vitamin. So I definitely think that it wouldn't hurt to have, you know, to eat a balanced diet and, you know, getting protein and, you know, just nutritious meals and things like that. I definitely think that it wouldn't hurt.
Thank you.
So, with sensory overload, can McDonald's Sprite cause sensory overload? Because that is a lot of sensory there.
Yeah. I would say probably so. Or McDonald's sweet tea. Yeah. All of that sugar in there. Yeah.
Yeah. Is it possible to like end up on a different level of the spectrum after you, like, let's say you were like a level 3 at one point, end up being like a level 1 after you've gotten so used to like the daily routine of it?
So I do think that you can kind of interchangeably go between levels. You know, I don't think that you backtrack significantly if you are on the spectrum. You can, but I do think that, like I said before, like as an individual gets older, right? You know, as with everyone, our brain develops, right? As we get older and we kind of learn, we all learn right from wrong. Those things might be difficult for someone, more difficult for someone on the spectrum. But I do think it, especially if they are higher functioning, that things will get better over time, that they may be able to better manage their symptoms and they wouldn't need necessarily the additional assistance. And others may, they may need that additional, like you said, medical and therapy, but then they may also have social supports like their family that, you know, they get to a point where they've got that social support and they don't need necessarily therapy for the rest of their life or, you know, but they, I definitely think like staying in contact with a doctor and, you know, things like that is to, you know, for the duration of, you know, because this is something that we said, you know, can't be cured. So I definitely think, you know, staying in contact with a medical provider, but as far as therapy goes, I don't think that they would need it like lifelong. And they could interchangeably, you know, change between levels, definitely.
Okay.
Throughout. Yeah.
So different levels. I guess I should have asked this earlier when you guys were talking about it. What are the different levels of the spectrum? Because
yeah, so we have 3 different levels, level 1, 2, and 3. And so each level is just has different criteria of like what impairment is based on, you know, and so that could be part of that criteria could be that they take into consideration if they are verbal or nonverbal. That is one of them. But another thing we see in children or teens with autism too is we may see more of the like physical side of it, like physical, maybe they have a disability, like we said, an intellectual disability too. So they've got something else going on too. So like that can also have to do with it if something physically is going on, physical.
So from the lower end to the higher end, I guess, like so. Level 1 would be the lower end where they're managing, and level 3 would be the higher end where they need
right
more assistance with right. a lot of things. Okay.
Sure, yeah.
So, Alyssa, we're coming to the end of the podcast, and I want to thank you for being here today. And one last question in terms of resources. I'm thinking for people that perhaps English is not their native language, and they're, you know, by listening to this podcast, they, you know, sort of pick up those symptoms and they may want to seek help. Mm-hmm. Are there available resources of in terms of different languages for people to access help and assistance?
Sure. So I think generally there is, it's just knowing where those are and knowing, I think it's important for us as therapists and counselors to know too, when we are dealing with a language barrier, you know, to have resources, to have our own backed up, you know, to be able to give to people that may not speak English, you know, and to provide them resources or have, you know, maybe a therapist or counselor speaks some language themselves and can help them, you know, but also having those resources to be able to give. I think having that and being prepared is something to be to that's proactive in helping people from different cultures that maybe necessarily don't speak English and have a child on the spectrum.
That's great to know because there's a lot of communities that, again, and they may speak English, but it's not their native language. Native. So they need that comfort level. It's not there. So it's good for them to know that there are resources available for them as well.
Right.
Thank you so much. You covered so much. It was a lot of information, very useful information. Thank you so much for being here today. And I want to thank the audience for joining us once again at Here We Are The Rock. And see you guys next time. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to We Are The Rock, the official podcast for Rivers of Hope Counseling. Visit us online at riversofhopecounseling.com or call us at 855-326-HOPE to schedule your session. Follow us on social media and remember to share this podcast with your friends and family. And tune in next month. Rivers of Hope Counseling, for a better tomorrow.